Okay. As I mentioned, we are going to be talking about challenging collection judgments. And there's people out there that have gotten judgments. There's people out there that know they've gotten judgments, and there's people that maybe just found out that they got a judgment placed against them. They had no clue there was any court case against them. And usually that is a sign that there was something like sewer service done. Sewer service is where you are not served properly. The process server says, oh, yeah, I served Tom, Dick, or Harry. But in reality, they didn't. They got paid for doing it, and they swore that they served somebody. But in reality, that didn't happen. But there's other situations that happen where you can do things about dealing with judgments. So let's start in here. This information is coming out of the Collection Actions book from the NCLC, National Consumer Law Center .org. If you are thinking about possibly buying any of these books, there are different ones. There's Fair Debt Collection. There is Collection Actions. There is Fair Credit Reporting Act. I have purchased all of those. There's a book on foreclosures. There's books on other things. These are the books that the attorneys use that are the consumer attorneys that work on our side of the fence. This is the material that they use. So let's talk about setting aside a default, stipulated, or litigated judgment. We've got an introduction here. Studies find that over 80% of consumer collection actions result in default judgments. Now, over 80% default judgments simply because people don't do something. And those are for the collector, obviously. All right. Later, particularly when a creditor initiates post-judgment remedies, that's after they get the judgment and they want to come after you and start collecting on that, consumers may seek legal representation or attempt on their own to reopen the default judgment. Consumers may also seek to set aside a stipulated judgment. Stipulated judgments consented to in the original credit documents, known as cognovits, and that's spelled cognovits, or confessions of judgment, are generally illegal. Really kind of interesting. There's some states that have various things there. If you are in a state where you may have something like that, you want to do some Googling and see what you can find on that. They are generally illegal and will not be considered in this publication. Nor will this section discuss settlements reached at arm's length when the consumer is represented by an attorney, because then it's a different ballgame when you have an attorney dealing with it. Such settlements are examined elsewhere in the manual. When an unrepresented consumer attends a court hearing on the debt, a favorite collector technique, sometimes encouraged by judges or other court personnel, is to take the consumer out into the corridor, and I imagine I'm hitting familiar territory here with some people, take the consumer out into the corridor and resolve the matter without appearing before the judge. This procedure has clear potential for abuse, as unrepresented consumers go up against sophisticated collection attorneys and then sign documents they do not fully understand, often without being fully informed about their options to contest the matter in court. In other words, they go up against a sophisticated attorney when they are ignorant. And that's not saying stupid, not at all. Ignorant of the facts and what the law is and what they can do is the situation. Even though the consumer may have valid defenses, collectors may succeed in obtaining more than they could have obtained from the court just by persuading the consumer to sign a stipulation for judgment drafted by the collector's attorney. Now, gee, if the collector's attorney is drafting something, which way do you think it's going to be tilted? The stipulation may be one-sided, including inflated amounts as to the balance due, future interest charges, and attorney's fees. As a result, the ability to set aside a stipulated judgment will be considered in this action, along with the ability to set aside a default judgment. State rules for setting aside a judgment are generally identical. Now, I'm going to say that again. State rules for setting aside a judgment are generally identical, regardless of whether the judgment is a result of a default, stipulation, or a contested action. As a result, this section considers how to set aside a judgment in any of these situations, with special emphasis on default judgments and to a lesser extent on stipulated judgments into which an unrepresented consumer may have entered. That being, of course, if you went out in the hall and talked to them and they conned you into signing something, thinking, well, we're going to give you a better deal. Well, no, they're not going to give you a better deal. They're still going to try and stick it to you. Okay, general principles on this. So the first step in setting aside a default judgment should be to fax or otherwise contact the collector's attorney and ask the attorney to voluntarily set aside the judgment. Now, that may seem kind of strange. What do you mean, go contact the collector's attorney and ask him to back off? Well, practitioners report surprising success with this request. Now, if you're doing this as a pro se, I would guess that you're not going to have quite as much success as you would with an attorney. But keep in mind, this is the first step. Okay, certain trial judges have little sympathy for even unsophisticated pro se defendants who fail to properly answer and contest a collection action and are loath to set aside default judgments. Now, we know that. We know that some judges are just crooks. They're only there to hand your earnings to a debt collector if they get half a chance to do so. You can't really do a lot about that at this point. We're making headway on that. But state law is generally favorable to allowing a default judgment to be set aside. A state's procedure to set aside a judgment is remedial and should be liberally construed so that justice is served. Okay? Case citation on that. K-A-Y, V, Mark, M-A-R-C, Glassman Incorporated, spelled G-L-A-S-S-M-A-N. Inc. That is a 1996 Ohio case. And that, I'll read the sentence again that it relates to. A state's procedure to set aside a judgment is remedial and should be liberally construed so that justice is served. And that justice is served is a very good thing to put in your pleadings. For example, the New Jersey Supreme Court has stated that a court should view the opening of default judgments with great liberality and should tolerate every reasonable ground for indulgence to the end that a just result is reached. Okay, we've got several case citations here. Mancini, spelled M-A-N-C-I-N-I, V E D S, and then it's X REL, E X space R E L. Okay, then we have New Jersey Auto. This is kind of interesting. Full, F U L L, Insurance Underwriting. UNDERWRITING Association. That's New Jersey, 1993. Okay, you also have GEER, spelled G-E-E-R, V, Jacobson, J-A-C-O-B-S-O-N. OBSEN. That's a Florida District Court appellate from 2004. You have LVNV Funding, LLC, v. DICICO, spelled D-I, capital C-I-C-C-O. It is a New Jersey Superior Court appeal from June of 2010. Another one is NCO, Portfolio Management, versus Lorenzo, L-O-R-E-N-Z-O. And that is another New Jersey Superior Court Appellate Division from September of 10. So you've got some real good citations. There's more, but I'm not going to read them all. These books are absolutely loaded with this information. Okay. Doubts should be resolved in favor of the consumer who is seeking to reopen the default judgment. Okay, we've got a couple citations here. Again, it's that one that I read at the beginning earlier is Mancini v. EDS XREL. That is one of them. Then another citation is Portfolio Recovery Associates, LLC, versus Thacker, T-H-A-C-K-E-R. It's Ohio Court of Appeals, August of 2009. Okay, Washington Supreme Court has stated that it, quote, is the policy of the law that controversies be determined on the merits rather than by default. Okay, we have a case there, which is Griggs, G-R-I-G-G-S, v. Averbeck, A-V-E-R-B-E-C-K, Realty, Inc. That is a 79 case from Washington, and it quotes Dlouhy, spelled D-L-O-U-H-Y v. Dlouhy, same name, D-L-O-U-H-Y, and that is a 1960 case from Washington. Okay, a New York appellate court also has stated that a default should be reopened in view of a showing of a potentially meritorious defense. The absence of legal prejudice to the plaintiff, and we're going to discuss that more, as a result of the delay, and the strong public policy of resolving disputes on the merits. It all comes back to a default is just, well, the guy or the woman never gets their day in court, so to speak. There is a case citation for that, Capital One Bank v. Roman, R-O-M-A-N. New York case from 2007. A number of state Supreme Courts have stated that default judgments are disfavored and the trial court is vested with broad discretion to set them aside. Now, say those words again, broad discretion to set them aside. All right, we've got couple things here. I can give you several case citations. There's a bunch of them here, but I'm not going to read them all. Idaho state police. XREL, that's E-X space R-E-L period, Russell, R-U-S-S-E-L-L, V Sharp Properties, just says P-R-O-P, situated in county of Cassia, spelled C-A-S-S-I-A. That is a Idaho case from 2007. We also have Asset Acceptance, LLC. Let's see, versus Moberly, M-O. B-E-R-L-Y, that is a 2007 case from Kentucky. Also have Kennedy, K-E-N-N-E-D-Y, V. Black. That is a 1981 case from Pennsylvania. And then there's also Asset Acceptance, LLC, versus Moberly. And this is a Kentucky Court of Appeals case, May 15th of 2009. Okay, the trial judge's decision will not be disturbed on appeal, absent an abuse of discretion. Okay, let's say that again. The trial judge's decision will not be disturbed on appeal, absent an abuse of discretion. In other words, if the judge hasn't abused his discretion, then the appeals court will not change it. They will not remand it back. They'll leave it stand. And there is a case citation for that. Atlantic, ATL period, Credit and Finance versus Dustrud, spelled D-U-S-T-R-U-D-E. That is a Minnesota Court of Appeals case from March of 08. There is also one other one, Mancini, M-A-N-C-I-N-I, V-E-D-S, X-REL, E-X space R-E-L period, New Jersey, Auto, Full, Insurance, Underwriting Association. I know that's a long one. New Jersey, Auto, Full, Insurance, Underwriting Association. That is a New Jersey case, 1993. All right, let's talk about state standards for setting aside a judgment. The precise standards to set aside a default judgment are found in a state's statutes or rules of procedure. Okay, this is giving you a clue where to go look at things. Procedures differ for different level courts within the same state and from state to state. Here again, this is an example of it's very good to go and read the local rules of your court. You need to know what the local rules are. A good starting point is the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, because many states pattern their procedures after these rules. Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 55, parens C. When I say parens C, that means it's C with parentheses around it. When I say parens D, that means D with parentheses around it. For those of you that don't understand that, I want to make sure you get the gist of what we're saying here. Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 55C states that a default judgment can be set aside pursuant to Rule 60, parens B. And most states have a parallel rule. Okay, I'm not going to go through. They've got a whole listing of things here. But again, Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 55C states that a default judgment can be set aside pursuant to Rule 60B, and most states have a parallel rule. So what you want to do is go look for a parallel rule. The federal version of Rule 60B states that a final judgment can be set aside for the following reasons. Number one, mistake, inadvertence, inadvertence, surprise, or excusable neglect. Okay, if you've made a mistake, you got an inadvertent error, there's a surprise, or there's excusable neglect, those all apply. Okay, number two, certain newly discovered evidence. Three, fraud, misrepresentation, or misconduct by an opposing party. Gee, how many times have we had those enter into things? Number four, the judgment is void. Number five, the judgment has been satisfied, released, or discharged. It is based on an earlier judgment that has been reversed or vacated, or applying it prospectively is no longer equitable. Or, and number six is, any other reason that justifies relief. Well, you have to make your arguments. You want to have something to base it on when you make an argument. But if you've got a good argument that justifies relief, then you can see about getting a judgment set aside. All right. Rule 60D, as in dog, states that Rule 60B, as in boy, does not limit a court's power to entertain an independent action to set aside a judgment for fraud on the court. Okay? It does not limit a court's power to entertain an independent action to set aside a judgment for fraud on the court. If somebody's made fraud on the court, getting a judgment against you, you're not prohibited from going after them. The same standards for setting aside the default judgment apply to setting aside a stipulation for judgment or a litigated judgment. A litigated judgment, obviously, is one that's been through the court procedure. State rules generally follow the example of the federal version of Rule 60, which states that, quote, on motion and just terms, the court may relieve a party or its legal representative from a final judgment, order, or proceeding for the following reasons, unquote. Okay. By its own language, this rule applies to any type of judgment and not just to default judgments. Now, a lot of times what you guys are going to be dealing with out there, I know, are these default judgments. Well, I didn't know anything. I just found your call, and I got this judgment 2 months ago or 3 months ago. all is not necessarily lost. All right, most states enumerate similar grounds to those found in Rule 60, but there are variations. Okay, I'll read you just a little bit of what's here, just briefly. And I'm going to go through this fast. Don't try and write this down, just so you have an idea of what information is here. The amount of variation differs by state. See example, Arizona Rule Civil Procedure 60C, largely following the federal rule, but shortening the one-year period to 6 months. Kentucky, little variation. Minnesota, interpreting any other reason that justifies relief to be limited to a reason that is extraordinary in nature. And see, Minnesota is a nasty state. New Jersey, little variation. New York, time periods are different. Lack of jurisdiction is a ground instead of judgment is void. And other reason that justifies relief is not included. Ohio deletes judgment is void as a ground. So there's various things that that are in here. All right. Most states enumerate similar grounds to those found in Rule 60, but there are variations, and thus it is important to carefully parse a particular state's standards. In other words, you have to go and look it up and read and see what your state allows. What does it actually say? One court has estimated that 35 states have adopted language substantially the same as the federal rules. 8 states have reserved equity or broad powers to revise a final judgment, and the remainder limit the grounds to be set aside a judgment to set aside a judgment to specific certain situations. All right, and there's actually a case citation on that, which is Andreessen, spelled A-N-D-R-E-S-E-N v. Andreessen, same name, which is a Maryland case from 1989. Some states also allow a default judgment to be set aside within 30 days without requiring any special reasons for the action. All right? Now, that's important for people that have had something more recent. An example in here is Alaska Rules of Civil Procedure 55C. Maine has a second standard applicable specifically to collection actions on consumer debt, allowing either the court on its own motion or the consumer to seek while the court retains jurisdiction to modify or revoke the order as the interest of justice may require. Now, this is something that I've put in a number of pleadings that I have written, helped write for people, is in the interest of justice. You know, you always want to remind the court when you're putting something before them that this is what you're wanting is in the interest of justice. Remind them of that. Okay, Maryland's rules allow for a default judgment to be revised only for fraud, mistake, or irregularity, newly discovered evidence, or clerical mistakes. And these terms are strictly applied. Okay, and there is a case citation for that, which is Bland, B-L-A-N-D, v. Hammond, H-A-M-M-O-N-D, and this is a Maryland Court of Appeals, 2007. Okay, Georgia, Connecticut, and Iowa are other examples of states that are far more restrictive than the federal rules as to the grounds set aside a judgment. Georgia limits the grounds to lack of jurisdiction, fraud, accident, or mistake, as the acts of the adverse party unmixed with the negligence or fault of the movant. Now, for those of you that are new, a movant is the party that's bringing the suit, or a non-amendable defect which appears upon the face of the record or pleadings, showing that no claim in fact existed. Connecticut sets a strict 4-month time limit on reopening a default judgment. Okay, see, there's one that really cuts you back. Connecticut sets a strict 4-month time limit on reopening a default judgment and requires a showing of reasonable cause, or that a good cause of action or defense in whole or in part existed, and that the plaintiff or defendant was prevented by mistake, accident, or other reasonable cause from making the defense. Iowa has a similar provision with a 60-day deadline. Boy, am I glad I moved out of Iowa. Wow, I lived there for 32 years. I think it was about 36 too many. But even in these states, the consumer should be able to set aside the judgment after that period if the court lacked jurisdiction to award the judgment, such as when the consumer was never properly served with process. And that is a big issue. Service of process is going to be a really, really big issue. Now, they go in here to timing considerations. You know, timing of this stuff is important. Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 60C requires that a motion under Rule 60B be made within a reasonable time, and if based on any of the following, no more than 1 year after the entry of judgment. 1, mistake, inadvertence, surprise, or excusable neglect. And we've heard this, we talked about this earlier. 2, newly discovered evidence. 3 is where you hit the fraud, misrepresentation, or misconduct by an opposing party. And there's actually a case citation here for this. That is First Resolution Investment Corp versus Coffey, COFFEY. That is an Ohio appeals court decision, December of 07. Some state rules provide only 4 or 6 months, and this is Alaska or Alabama is 4 months, Arizona 6 months, California 6 months, Connecticut 4 months. All right, they only provide only 4 or 6 months to make such a motion instead of 1 year, while others appear to have no time limits. Arkansas, no time limits. That's pretty good. Rule 60C does not set a time limit other than within a reasonable time for the other 3 grounds to set aside a judgment. Those being 4, the judgment is void. 5, the judgment has been satisfied or released or discharged. And these are ones that we've already gone over. That's why I'm going over this a little quick here. And it is based on an earlier judgment that has been reversed or vacated, or applying it prospectively is no longer equitable. Or 6, any other reason that justifies relief. In addition, Rule 60D states that Rule 60C on timing, and see, you can see right now that you need to go in and look at these Rule 60 very carefully and read this so that you understand what these things are saying. That's a very important part regarding these judgments and dealing with them. In addition, Rule 60D states that 60C on timing does not limit a court's power to entertain an independent action. Again, it does not limit a court's power to entertain an independent action to set aside a judgment for fraud on the court. so that there is no time limit on such an action. So if you've got a situation where there was obvious fraud, there's no time limit on it, even if you discovered that it happened, you know, 4, 5, 6 years ago. Whether or not there is a one-year limit, an action under 60B must be brought within a reasonable time, which will depend on the totality of circumstances. Okay, and there is a case citation for this. Great Seneca, spelled S-E-N-E-C-A, Finance Corp. V. Dweck, D-W-E-K. And that is a New Jersey appeals decision from April of 08. When a consumer moves to set aside the default shortly after learning of the judgment, the motion will generally be considered to have been made within a reasonable time. In other words, might be something like Richard had a few months back, and he did get his judgment vacated. His was a case where he pulled his credit report and found a judgment in there. He had no idea existed because they had done a bogus service. So here again it says, when a consumer moves to set aside the default shortly after learning of the judgment, the motion will generally be considered to have made within a reasonable time. The sooner the motion is brought, the stronger will be the consumer's position. I mean, that's kind of common sense. You know, if you found out about it in January last year and here it is April of the next year and you're thinking about doing something about it, that does not reflect well. If they say, well, when did you find out about this? Well, you know, it was a year ago, but I've been busy. Don't put yourself in that position. It's against you. Courts will look for the consumer's diligence in bringing the motion to set aside judgment after the consumer realizes action is necessary. You know, that's common sense. While the consumer should act promptly when the consumer becomes aware of the need to set aside the judgment, this does not mean the consumer needs to immediately file a motion, but can instead enter into discussions with the other party. Okay, there is a citation for that. Webb, W-E-B-B, versus Erickson, E-R-I-C-K, S-O-N, it's a 1982 Arizona case. Moreover, courts have stated that it is only a secondary factor whether the consumer showed due diligence in seeking to set aside the default after realizing that such action is necessary. Okay, and there's a case citation. Little versus King, K-I-N-G. That is a Washington case from 2007. Okay. Counting from when a judgment is issued, there is no fixed time frame when the motion to set aside the judgment must be brought, as long as the action is brought within any maximum time period. Okay, an example is 1 year for certain grounds, as set out in a state rule or statute. Certainly 1 month is a reasonable time frame. Okay, and there's actually some case citations here on that. Here again, certainly 1 month is a reasonable time frame. So if you just had a recent judgment, there's no reason to keep you from doing it. And that would be Columbia Recovery Corp. v. Menchaca, spelled M-E-N-C-H-A-C-A. That is a New Jersey appeals case from March of 08. You can also see General Motors Acceptance Corporation versus Deskins, spelled D-E-S-K-I-N-S. And this is an Ohio appeals court from 84. And there's a note here. motion timely when filed 3 months after judgment entered and 1 month after defendant learned of judgment. Okay, that's something directly related to that case. All right, an appellate court has found an 8-month delay to be reasonable where the consumer retained legal counsel after the default, but that counsel failed to take action for 6 months. The consumer then had to retain other counsel, explaining the 8-month delay. And that case citation is Capital One Bank versus Largent, L-A-R-G-E-N-T. And that is a Missouri Court of Appeals case from 2010. In cases where the consumer seeks to set aside a default for any other reason that justifies relief, courts have also allowed the consumer to bring the action years after the judgment, 4.5 years in one case where the individual had no reason to believe the action was related to that individual and the individual's mental and physical condition was impaired at the time. Okay, the case on that is Webb, W-E-B-B, versus Erickson, E-R-I-C-K-S-O-N, and that is Arizona, 1982. In another case, it was allowed 9 years after the judgment. This was New York Hospital versus Robinson, and that's R-O-B-I-N-S-O-N. That was a New Jersey appeals court from May of 1999. Moreover, where a judgment is void, there should be no limit at all for the consumer's right to bring an action to set aside the judgment. All right. Let's go on to meritorious defense. Before setting aside a judgment, courts typically want to be satisfied that the consumer has a meritorious defense. In other words, that you've got some legitimate sense of why you should be able to do that, not just some bogus idea. And there's a number of case citations here. I'll give you several. Gear, G-E-E-R, versus Jacobson, J-A-C-O-B-S-O-N. That is a Florida case from 2004. And another one that we've heard before, but I'll go through this. Asset Acceptance, LLC, versus Moberly, M-O-B. E-R-L-Y. That's a 2007 case from Kentucky. Here's another one that's been mentioned. And you know, you notice that you hear some of these same names. There's some really good information that comes out of some of these cases. That's why they're cited for more than one reason. Capital One Bank versus Largent. L-A-R-G-E-N-T. That's a Missouri case from 2010. One more is Asset Acceptance, LLC, versus Scott, S-C-O-T-T. New Jersey Court of Appeals, 2007. Right. The court may not want to expend resources deciding whether to set aside a judgment and then retry the case if the consumer has no defense to the action. The meritorious defense should be pleaded with some particularity, more so than in responding to the original complaint. In other words, when you're going back trying to vacate a judgment, you want to come up with some good, solid arguments. Don't have something weak, because if you have something weak, you're going to be in a position where the court can just say, well, you know, they really didn't show any, you know, good, definite reason why we should, so we won't. All right, I'm going to give you one case on that. Meglan, M-E-G-L-A-N, comma, Meglan, again, M-E-G-L-A-N, and Company versus Bostic, B-O-S-T-I-C. That's an Ohio case from May of 2006. Nonetheless, the consumer need only allege a meritorious defense, not prove that the consumer will prevail on that defense. And that's really important to understand. I'm going to read that again. Nonetheless, the consumer need only allege a meritorious defense. In other words, putting up a good defense, not prove that the consumer will prevail on that defense. And that case citation that I gave you, the Meglan, Bostic, that is cited for that. There's also another one, which is Portfolio Recovery Associates, LLC, versus Thacker, T-H-A-C-K-E-R. That's from Ohio in August of 2009. And again, as everyone can see from this information, these case citations are pretty new. This isn't all stuff going back 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. This is all very recent information, which is really good. A proffered defense is meritorious when it is not a sham, and when, if true, it states a defense in part or in whole to the claims for relief set forth in the complaint. And remember, you always got to go back and see what the original complaint said when you're dealing with this kind of situation. And again, a case citation on that is going to be the one that it was Meglan and Company versus Bostic. The consumer's allegation of a meritorious defense certainly can be made by affidavit. And here again, this goes back to what we were talking about last week, doing the affidavits. They are a very powerful tool. Consumer's allegation of a meritorious defense certainly can be made by affidavit. There need not be a mini trial of the facts. Okay, and there is a couple of cases here. Actually, a couple of them that we've already hit on. One is Webb versus Erickson, Arizona, 1982. And again, the Meglan versus Bostic. Courts may not even require that evidence supporting the defense be presented as part of the motion. Okay. That can be done with an affidavit. And normally, I would suggest that when you go to try and get rid of a default judgment, you're going to want to include an affidavit that's made out, because that's putting you on record in a sworn statement that certain things possibly did not happen. Or did happen, depending on what the case may be. Okay. Although a meritorious defense can be almost any valid defense, courts may look more kindly on the consumer's motion when the consumer's defense is apparent on the face of the collector's pleadings, as when the form of the complaint fails to meet state requirements. And, you know, you need to see if the complaint they made even met state requirements. And there is a case citation here. ATL period. So it looks like it might be Atlanta, but it's ATL period. Cr- Credit and Finance, Inc. versus Giuliana, spelled Giuliana, and that is a Pennsylvania case from 2003. Okay, when a complaint fails to meet state requirements or when insufficient evidence was presented to support a prima facie case. Remember that some of these debt collectors don't even include a lot of what they need to make a case when they file it. And here again, that'll take a little bit of research on your part to go and find out if they did put the proper information there. If they didn't, you can deal with it right there. Case citation on this one is Morales, Morales, versus Santiago, spelled Santiago, and that's a New Jersey appeals court from 1987. That one goes back a ways. Similarly, when the consumer claims never to have opened an account, a meritorious defense is established when the collector offers little evidence that the individual opened the account or was otherwise obligated on the account. Citation on that, Columbia Recovery Corp. versus Menchaca. This is one I believe we mentioned before, M-E-N-C-H-A-C-A, and this is New Jersey Appeals Court from March of 08. All right, now need to talk about another subject here, which is prejudice to the prevailing party. Now, this is something that has to be taken into consideration. A few courts consider as one factor in determining whether to set aside a judgment, whether setting aside the judgment will cause substantial prejudice to the opposing party. Okay, case citation on that. Rule, R-U-L-E, versus Capital One Bank. That's a Kentucky appeals case from March of 07. And ATL, period, Credit and Finance versus Dustrud. We've mentioned this one already, but again, that's spelled D-U-S-T-R-U-D-E. That's a Minnesota appeals case from March of 08. And one other quick one is Little versus King, which is a Washington case from 2007. Okay. Now, going back, we'll read this again. A few courts consider as one factor in determining whether to set aside a judgment, whether setting aside judgment will cause substantial prejudice to the opposing party. But this has been called a secondary factor, just one factor to be weighed among others. Prejudice also is more than that, that the collector, may not win on the merits if the judgment is set aside. The prejudice is not that the case may have a different outcome, but that the other party is no longer able to present its case because of the passage of time. All right? I hope you understand that. If something's really old, if they can't, so to speak, recreate and re-prosecute, then that is prejudicial to them. An example of prejudice that may be sufficient to merit denial of a motion to set aside a default is the plaintiff's death, when the plaintiff's estate would be without a witness if the case had to be relitigated. You know, that makes sense. And there is a case citation for that, which is Grunk, That's an interesting name. GRUNKE versus Kloskin, spelled KLOSKIN, which is a Minnesota case from 1984. All right. Let's go over mistake, inadvertence, surprise, or excusable neglect. I mean, obviously, if you're going to be dealing with that, you need to know a little bit about it. The most common ground to set aside a default judgment is mistake, inadvertence, surprise, or excusable neglect. Most cases focus on whether the consumer's neglect in responding to the case was excusable. But the federal rule and similar state rules also allow a judgment to be set aside because of mistake, inadvertence, or surprise. For example, consider where a consumer was under the impression that a settlement with the collector would result in the case's dismissal, but the collector obtained a default even though the consumer was meeting the terms of the settlement. In other words, crooked lawyer syndrome. The consumer's failure to participate could be termed mistake or surprise as easily as excusable neglect. Mistake may also apply to an unrepresented and unsophisticated consumer's confusion as to what legal rights are available and how to contest a proceeding. Okay, this is where a lot of new people are going to come in. I want to read this sentence again. Mistake may also apply to an unrepresented and unsophisticated consumer's confusion as to what legal rights are available and how to contest a proceeding. If nothing else, plead stupidity. I didn't know. I just want a fair hearing. I just want to get my day in court. Courts generally find that excusable neglect means that the consumer has a reasonable excuse for failing to respond to the complaint. The Ohio Supreme Court has defined excusable neglect in the negative by stating that the inaction of the defendant is not excusable neglect if it can be labeled as a complete disregard for the judicial system. Okay, where this is going to come in is somebody that's just really PO'd at the courts and, the whole system's corrupt and this and that. If you present that kind of thing, you may not get anywhere. Here again, I'm going to read this one more time. The Ohio Supreme Court, this is the Supreme Court of the state, has defined excusable neglect in the negative by stating that the inaction of the defendant is not excusable neglect if it can be labeled as a complete disregard for the judicial system. In other words, you got to plead something else instead of, I just don't think the courts are fair at all. That's just not going to get you much anywhere. And there is a case citation I'll give you on this one, which is K-K-A-Y, v. Mark, M-A-R-C, Glassman, G-L-A-S-S-M-A-N, Inc., and that is Ohio case from 1996. There's also Asset Acceptance, LLC, versus Allen, which is an Ohio case from 2009. And it says in parentheses here, consumer has burden of showing excusable neglect. In other words, you got to explain why you made a mistake and that it was a mistake. And by the way, for all of you new people especially, using the word mistake is very important in legal matters because mistakes can be corrected. If you've screwed up somewhere, if you've made an error, you've made a mistake. Refer to it as a mistake. It's in your best interest. All right. The excuse need not be something beyond the consumer's control. Thus, the United States Supreme Court distinguished excusable neglect from another ground listed in Rule 60 to set aside a judgment, which is, quote, any other reason that justifies relief, unquote. The court found that unlike excusable neglect, any other reason that justifies relief only applies to factors over which the consumer has no control. Okay, and I've got a case citation here. Pioneer Investment Services Company. Versus Brunswick, Brunswick, Associates, LP, and that's a U.S. case from 1993. And there's also Asset Acceptance, LLC, versus Moberly. This is one we've already talked about, but still give it again. Moberly, which is a Kentucky case from 2007. All right. Thus, excusable neglect by implication can relate to factors over which the consumer has no control, but where the consumer still did not act. Excusable neglect has been found where, one, the consumer was out of town for several weeks without checking his mail. Okay. Two, a pro se defendant was confused as to court procedure or ignorant concerning the consequences of a default. All right. Now, there's a bunch of case citations here. Again, a pro se defendant was confused as to court procedure, and how many of you knew people have been in that boat, or ignorant concerning the consequences of a default. All right, I'm going to give you several case citations here. TCI Group Life Insurance Plan versus Knobler, spelled K-N-O-E-B-B-E-R, Knobber. And let's see, Ninth Circuit. That's a Ninth Circuit. And the note here is lack of familiarity with the legal system, while not sufficient in itself to demonstrate excusable neglect, is a relevant consideration. So is depression following spouse's death. Okay, another citation here. Canfield versus Van Atta, that's spelled V-A-N, new word, A-T-T-A, Buick / GMC Truck, Inc. That is a Second Circuit case from 1997. And the notes here is lack of familiarity with court rules may constitute excusable neglect. Okay, if you weren't familiar with the court rules, well, then plead excusable neglect. All right. The consumer, this, and now going back, excusable neglect has been found where, and we've gone one, two, then the consumer, after receiving a complaint, was told to forget it by the creditor's attorney. Oh, I love those kind of things. And there is a case citation on that one, which is General Motors Acceptance Corporation versus Deskins, D-E-S-K-I-N-S. That's Ohio, 1984. Okay. Another case is the consumer promptly asked an attorney for advice subsequent court notices went to the attorney, and the attorney never informed the consumer that the attorney was not taking the case. Well, that's crooked stuff on the part of the attorneys, obviously. Another case is a pro se litigant failed to inform the court of his new address. Yeah, if you don't give them your address, you can't hardly get the mail. The consumer requested a continuance but never received notice of the new court date, so did not attend. The collector sent the notice to the wrong address. Well, crooked lawyer. The consumer is incarcerated and did not receive notice of the action. Well, that's a pretty good reason. The consumer's husband appeared for the third time on behalf of the consumer, and the collector suddenly objected to the non-attorney husband representing the consumer, which led to a default judgment. Now, that's good. The consumer's husband appeared for the third time on behalf of the consumer, and the collector suddenly objected to the non-attorney husband representing the consumer, which led to a default judgment. In other words, shyster attorney. And that does happen. And the case there on that is Capital One Bank versus Largent, L-A-R-G-E-N-T. That's Missouri from 2010. All right. An important issue is whether failure to understand English can be the basis for excusable neglect. Two Delaware cases show some possible distinctions. In one case, the court found excusable neglect when the defendant could not speak or write English and depended on friends for translations, and when this language problem led to actual confusion. All right. And I'm going to give a case citation on this one that's here just for those of you. Maybe we have some people out here that deal with language issues, possibly Spanish or something. Canton, C-A-N-T-O-N, I-N-N, Incorporated, versus SEC, S-E-C, period, Insurance Company. And this is a Delaware Superior Court decision from January of 86. See, some of these do go back. The court found excusable neglect even though the defendant spoke some minimal English and ran a successful business. On the other hand, another court found no excusable neglect when the English was the defendant's second language and the defendant was somewhat difficult to understand, but spoke and understood English and did not need a translator. If you don't need a translator, then you can't make an argument on the language barrier. Okay, newly discovered evidence. Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 60B2 lists as grounds to set aside a judgment. Newly discovered evidence that with reasonable diligence could not have been discovered in time to move for a new trial under Rule 59B. Okay. There is a case citation for this. Cavalry, C-A-V-A-L-R-Y, Portfolio Services, LLC, v. Laufgass, spelled L-A-U-F-G-A-S. This is a New Jersey appeals court, March of 2010. Okay. Under Rule 59B, a party has 28 days to seek a new trial. As a result, if evidence is discovered within 28 days of a judgment, the proper procedure under the federal rules is to seek a new trial. After 28 days, the proper practice is to seek to set aside the judgment. So there is a difference there. You can either request a new trial if you're within the 28 days, after 28 days, the proper practice is to seek to set aside the judgment. An example of newly discovered evidence might be that a second collector is suing the consumer on the same debt. Wow, yeah, that'd be newly discovered. Raising new issues as to whether the collector with the judgment, in fact, owned the debt. Another example might be if it is discovered that a particular collector was systematically misrepresenting facts in its affidavits or improperly signing or notarizing the affidavits. Now, again, I'm going to refer everybody back. If you did not listen to the call from last week on Monday, we went over affidavits. And you always want to check over the affidavits very carefully to find out if the signer of an affidavit is a robo-signer. And you also want to find out if the notary is a robo-notary signer. They're out there. And look for defects in those. If they are not notarized, it's not an affidavit. Okay, fraud, misrepresentation, or misconduct by an opposing party. And I'm gonna kind of go through this a little quicker here. There's not a lot of case citations, but we'll cover this ground. The federal rules establish two different standards for setting aside a default judgment based upon the collector's misconduct. A collector's fraud, misrepresentation, or misconduct relating to the consumer is grounds for setting aside a default judgment if the consumer acts within 1 year to set aside the judgment. And that is Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 60B and 60C. On the other hand, when there is fraud on the court and not just misconduct affecting the consumer, the judgment can be set aside even after the one-year period. A good example of collector misconduct affecting the consumer would be a collector's attorney telling the consumer to forget about the complaint served by that attorney. Another good example of collector misconduct involves a collector representing to the consumer that it will dismiss the case if the consumer enters into a repayment program. Instead, the collector pursues the case and obtains a default judgment, even though the consumer makes payments as agreed. That is fraud on the court. Get off my book, Mr. Bug. You can tell summer's coming. Misrepresentation or misconduct can also occur where the collector convinces the consumer to agree to a stipulated judgment. That's a, you know, where you agree to have a judgment for something, including misrepresentations as to the nature of the document the consumer is signing. And how many times has somebody said, well, you know, this is the terms, and you sign something and you never read it? Get in the habit of reading these things, please, everybody. Okay, the document the consumer is signing or the implications of signing that document. If you don't read it, you don't know what the implications are. Also, grounds to set aside the judgment should be any misrepresentation made by the collector or its attorney as to the validity of the consumer's defenses. Look not only for collector misrepresentations, but also for unethical behavior by the collector's attorney, which should be considered misconduct sufficient to set aside a judgment. A state's code of legal ethics will have provisions concerning contacts with unrepresented individuals. For example, commentary to the Florida Bar Rule states that the other side's lawyer should not give advice to an unrepresented person other than the advice to obtain counsel. In other words, you shouldn't be getting advice as an unrepresented individual from the lawyer on the other side. And they try and do that all the time. That's part of that. Call you out in the hall. Well, you know, you really need to sign this because this is going to be much better than me getting a judgment against you and blah, 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 and this and that. They're giving you legal advice. That's not good. And you don't want to find yourself in that position. Okay. One court explained why it was particularly concerned about a stipulated settlement between a debt buyer and a pro se consumer. The circumstances at hand presented a classic case for granting such judicial relief. The defendant in this case, ignorant of her rights, signed an imprudent settlement agreeing to pay plaintiff, a debt buyer, monthly sums otherwise needed for food and rent. The settlement agreement obligated her to make payments to plaintiff monthly for more than 4 years. Although settlements like this often benefit both debtors and creditors, the defendant told the court in no uncertain terms that she had been intimidated into signing of the settlement, and the plaintiff had convinced her that she had no choice but to capitulate to plaintiff's demands. Under the circumstances presented, it was painfully obvious to the court that plaintiff obtained the settlement outside of court by taking undue advantage of the defendant. The judges of this court and the lawyers practicing before them know all too well that debt buyers rarely have readily available proof to establish an assigned debt claim. The pennies paid by debt buyers for the right to pursue stale and questionable claims certainly do not justify misleading and heavy-handed collection tactics outside of court. When such matters actually come on for trial, they are typically abandoned, dismissed, or compromised for a small fraction of their hypothetical value. And I find that very interesting. And a case citation there is LR Credit 21 LLC versus, I'm not even going to try and pronounce this one, I will spell the name for you, P-A-R-Y S-H K-U-R-A. And that is a New York District Court case from 2010. Typically, the question of the collector's misconduct will be one of credibility between the consumer and the collector's attorney as to what was said in the corridor. Trying such a dispute may be inconvenient for the collector because ethical rules may require the collector to find a new attorney to handle the motion to set aside the stipulated judgment, because the collector's first attorney will be a witness in the matter. Remember, an attorney cannot testify. They are either representing someone or they can be a witness, but not both. Never let them be both. Always object, 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 object if they try and do that. A collector's filing false affidavits with the court should be not just misconduct affecting the consumer, but also fraud upon the court. State rules may require that certain documentation be presented to the court before a default judgment will be issued. False statements in that documentation should also be fraud upon the court. An example might be when an affidavit states certain facts upon the affiant's personal knowledge, when the affiant cannot possibly have that personal knowledge. Another is where the collector signs affidavits in bulk in one location and then sends them to another to be notarized in bulk. Can you say robo-signing? In arguing for an expansive reading of both collector misconduct and fraud upon the court, remember that the consumer is not seeking damages and need not prove all the elements of fraud. Instead, the consumer is seeking equity so that the consumer can be heard upon the merits when the collector's misrepresentation prevented that from occurring. Okay. I tell you what, there's more material here, but we have spent a bunch of time on this. I think we're going to end up finishing this up next week. I don't want to go too long on this. This gets to be a little too much if you spend too much time on it. And